Good to see everyone who's here, and we're going to continue our discussion, obviously, of the cults, and as Percy said in the prayer, in particular, dealing with the religion of Islam, or the Muslims. And by way of a very brief review, I have put up this chart every time. I'm not going to so much look at this, because I am at right about midway through the lesson, but especially three out of these 5 points. By the time we reach the end of the lesson today, we will have pretty much looked at 3 out of 5 of these points, and that will leave us with the all-important point number 3 and point number 5 to pursue in the last couple of lessons. So that kind of tells you where we are, where we're going. But where we are and where we have come thus far, we have said several times, let me run through these first couple very quickly. We've said that in order to understand the Muslim religion, or the religion of Islam, and I'll use those interchangeably as they do, you need to gain a working knowledge of the Arabic people. We've said that it is an ethnic as well as a religious cult, and we should understand that. And while a lot of people equate it with the Arabic nations, as we will come to see at the latter part of tonight's lesson, it goes way beyond the Middle East and way beyond the Arabic nations. But to understand it, nonetheless, you've got to understand that culture and history. There really just is no understanding the religion without it. This is a religion more rooted in history and culture than perhaps any other. I mean, excepting, of course, the important history of our own religion. The Arabic people acknowledge themselves, and we pointed this out, that they are descendants of Abraham through various lines, excepting Isaac, of course. They refer to themselves as the nation of Abraham, and they believe, and their various beliefs, as the religion of Abraham. They lay claims to the lands of the Middle East by right of covenant. And we pointed that out. I'm not going to go through all of that history, but a number of you have found that a very compelling history, and I appreciate that. Because it is something that does lay a lot of background to this religion. But really what you had by the time of Muhammad was a very competitive religious environment in which you had Jews and Christians and Arabs all vying with one another and all laying claim, as it were, to these lands from both an ethnic as well as a religious right. And into that environment, Muhammad was born in AD 70. Remember we said he was orphaned and really grew up with his uncle, who was a caravan trader. And that was very important because it carried him into a number of lands as far away as Syria, remember. It brought him into contact with all of these different religions and cultures, including the Arabic idolatry, as well as the Jewish and Christian religions, and of course the cultures of all those people. He later worked for and eventually married a woman by the name of Khadija. Then that gave him wealth, and it gave him time, and that's very important, because it allowed him, and she encouraged his religious pursuits, and that allowed him to develop a lot of what we see today. We also said last time, and I think it's very important to reiterate this, I won't say a lot more about it after this point, but it is important to realize it, that his people were mainly idolatrous pagans. In the 6th century, in Mecca, his hometown, for example, there was that building, the Kaaba, remember that? And his people in particular guarded that shrine. And it had that black stone that is still there today that he rededicated, if you remember at the end of last week's lesson. It was a stone and a shrine built around a stone that they said came from and went all the way back to the time of Adam. It's probably really a meteorite from ancient times of some distant past. But they said and they believe, and this is important to their beliefs, that Abraham and Ishmael had rebuilt that shrine, Kaaba, and positioned that black stone within the walls. And then, of course, Muhammad comes along and really makes a new religion surrounding that shrine. And Mecca becomes a holy city. There is the black stone, and there is the current Kaaba shrine in Mecca. When that all that surrounding that little building is a sea of Muslims, as you can see there, in this mosque at Mecca. Kaaba figures prominently in Muhammad's life, both to the establishment and the development of Islam. And remember that he adopted that idolatrous God, or that false God, Allah, adopted that idol, though, as the one God of Abraham and the ancient prophets. Now, I'll mention these prophets in just a moment as we get into some new material. But just remember that he adopted Allah and named Abraham's God Allah instead of course, Jehovah. He would take Ramadan off and do his meditating out in that cave outside of Mecca. And finally, he came to associate himself with the Hanafa, those who turn away. And it was there, beginning with that little band of people who objected to the idolatry and began to listen to Muhammad as he organized them into a new religion, that they really are the roots of the Muslims. They're the first ones, or at least those who are behind it. They will be the first Muslims. At age 40, and somebody was wanting me to put some dates on some of this, so I'm doing some of this for that. About 610, he would be 40 years old. Muhammad is supposed to have begun to receive these revelations from Allah through, remember, the angel Gabriel. By the way, they consider Gabriel the archangel, incidentally. I don't know if I ever said that, but nonetheless, he began to receive these so-called revelations from Allah. Not really, but he's saying that. About 12 years later, AD 62, this is, and again, someone was asking me this, so let me try to relate this. This is shortly before Khadijah dies, within 5 years, but she is still alive. In AD 622, he began publicly proclaiming Allah is one and teaching submission. Literally, the word for submission is Islam. So when we talk about the religion of Islam, and that's very important, we talk about a religion of complete submission. And that's the way to Allah, and of course, he was teaching also that he was Allah's final prophet, and that's very important. He did gain some followers as early as 622, and those Hunafa were with him, but basically he met with a lot of opposition, as you can imagine, and they had to flee to Medina, called Yathrib at the time, but to Medina in the year 622, that same year. And that is considered, if you notice what I put in bold at the bottom, that is considered the beginning, the official beginning of the religion of Islam. So if you're wanting to put a date, a couple of you were wanting to do that. If you want to put an official date on the beginning of the religion of Islam, they consider it to have begun in the year 622. That's a map. It's not all that blurry, I guess, it kind of looks blurry from here, but. Anyway, that's a map showing you Mecca in present-day Saudi Arabia, called Arabia then, as it is in the Bible, incidentally. And Medina or Yathrib just to the north of Mecca. Now, from there, Muhammad began uniting these tribes. Remember, there was a lot of warring. He's doing a lot of fighting and conquering over about a period of 8 years. By 630, he has an army of 10,000. He goes back to Mecca. Conquers Mecca and establishes it as his holy city, Kaaba as the most sacred site in Islam, rededicating it to Allah, but now Allah is the God of Abraham. And then he set out to destroy or convert everybody that didn't believe all of that, is what it amounts to. And by the time he dies, the arrow points to Mecca. And if you're looking at the dark brown area or dark rust-colored area, I'll slow down for a moment. By the time he died, 2 years later, and this is really an amazing feat, I've likened his conquest and the Islamic conquest to that of Alexander the Great. Alexander was a lot younger, but it moved with rapid speed over a huge area, and so does Muhammad's. And so what happens is he sweeps through all of Arabia, that whole rust-colored area. In less than 2 years, he's able to fully conquer, subdue, and everyone has either completely submitted to Allah, to Islam, or they've left. One of the two. There is no other religion. There is no tolerance of other religion. There's no religious freedom or anything like that. You either die, leave, or submit. And he's able to do that in a short period. Who knows how far he would have been able to carry it had he lived. Only God literally knows that. But He accomplished all of that in less than 2 years, and that's quite a feat. Now, incidentally, that's a cut-down version of a map you're going to see three times tonight and watch it grow, incidentally. Now, let's talk about the Muslim religion after Muhammad. Muhammad did die June the 8th, 632, at the age of 63. By the time of his death, as we said last time, the very last thing we said, most of the Arabian Peninsula, as we just showed on the map, had submitted to Islam, and he had united these tribes into a single Muslim, whichever you prefer, religious polity. It is now a nation. It had not been before. It had been scattered tribes and various cities, but it is now a nation. And there are two primary results that follow his death, and these are extremely important. You can't stress the importance enough when you're studying this religion. If anything, some have said these two things that follow his death are more important than him. They may not say this, but apologists looking at this have said so. But there are two primary results, and we'll note them both. Number one was the recording and the publishing of the Quran, also called the Quran and various spellings, but I'm going to always go with the more Arabic Quran, or apostrophe A-N, the Quran. It had not been written during Muhammad's lifetime, but right after his death, they began recording it. I'll talk about who they is, but they began recording and publishing the Quran. And secondly, there is the development, equally important, there is the development of various sects, if you want to call them denominations, just in thinking in those terms, whichever you prefer. But within the Muslim movement, there are these various sects. Now, these two things begin there, exist today, they're very important. So the writing or the publishing or whatever you want to call it of the Quran and the development of the various sects. Let's talk about the first one, the Quran. The Quran is considered the complete and final revelation of a faith, notice, that was revealed many times through Allah's prophets. If you talk to a Muslim and they're telling you about their faith, they will tell you, if you listen even to some that preach in America, you can catch this on television from time to time if you're interested in this kind of thing, and they will tell you that this is not a faith that began with Muhammad. That when Westerners like me or others, when we begin to say the religion began with Muhammad, that's not true, they say. It was a religion that was as ancient as time itself. Adam, the first prophet, was a Muslim, they will tell you. Noah, the last man alive before the flood and the first one that repopulated the earth, was a Muslim, they will tell you. And so this faith is the same faith, and that's what you should understand. That's what they believe. It reminds you, think in terms of when we were studying Joseph Smith. Remember how we said Joseph Smith said it was lost for 1,400 years, and then it was given to Joseph Smith, and all he was doing was reestablishing. It reminds you of that. Number of cults are like that. They're simply restoring something that's been lost over time. Well, supposedly there is a succession of prophets. None of them know, they say, how many really there were, but they all agree on four or five, and they will name for you Adam, Noah, Abraham, Moses, most of them will include, although maybe not everything in the so-called law of Moses, and Jesus. And so they will tell you that these prophets, that Muhammad was simply restoring the faith of these prophets. He is seen as Allah's supreme and final prophet. And you should notice that he supersedes all of these preceding. So when you talk about the holy man or the great man of the Islamic faith, yeah, it's still Muhammad. So you're not wrong in saying that. But he's simply the final in a succession. Though he does supersede, and he is referred to by them as the seal of the prophets, the final seal, once and for all, God's final prophet that he's given to the world. Incidentally, let me make one brief statement about this, lest someone ask me. I don't know how much you guys, some of you are fairly familiar with this religion already. So if you come to me and you ask, you say, but aren't they expecting sort of a Messiah-like figure? They are. And I will talk about that figure that some believe is alive today and some believe is coming in the future. But that's not to be confused with Muhammad. So let me just say that, anticipating a question, and just remember that I will come back to that. But nonetheless, he's referred to and believed to be the seal of the prophets. Muslims claim belief in the Bible, and this is interesting. They say they believe in this Bible, of course, but they maintain, like Joseph Smith, you know, it's been changed or corrupted over time, or like the Jehovah's Witnesses, we saw that as well. So the Quran is considered to be Allah's perfect and final revelation, and it supersedes, of course, the Bible. They will tell you that a good portion of the Bible is not true, that it's not the truth. It was simply added later by people that were corrupting it. So when they say they believe in the Bible, there's not much of it they would even claim to believe. But nonetheless, the Quran supersedes it. And there is a picture of one of the most ancient and perfect existing copies of the Quran. That thing comes from, I think, the 11th century, if I remember right. But that comes from a... That is an old thing. It's in the British Museum. And you get an idea of what an ancient Quran would have looked like. It's a book, obviously, written in Arabic, obviously. And big, bold letters jumping off the page at you. Rather pretty thing, really. Incidentally, looking at that thing, you'll notice that it is, relatively speaking, not that long. That's one of the things that impresses people when they first see it. It is a Bible. It is not a long, verbose Bible. Muslims believe in what they call the unique literary style. I'm not going to get deep into this because, you know, I don't really want to study textual criticism with regard to the Quran, because I'm sure you know what I think about the Quran, and I'm sure what you think about it. But when you ask them to defend, you know, we would talk about inspiration, the thing we're studying on Wednesday night. We talk about inspiration. We talk about all of the thing, you know, all of this that we're going into, like we're beginning to look on Wednesday nights at the manuscript evidence and all of that kind of thing. This is what they offer. They say the unique literary style of the Quran is its strongest supporting evidence. I find this interesting, really. Not Muhammad and his validity, because that's what we tend to argue. And it's interesting to me listening to the debate, just reading it, really, that goes on in the various writings. You get Westerners like us that are basically arguing against Muhammad, but you get Muslims that are defending the Quran. And even though we might look and we say, well, your whole religion is based on Muhammad, they say, no, our religion is based on the Quran. And they look at the Quran itself, and they consider the Quran to be its own best defense. They say in Arabic, in its original language, it has rhythmic qualities that delight the Arab's ears. In other words, it's aesthetically pleasing. It's written in an Arab rhyme. There's no way in the world to transmit or translate that into English, because it wouldn't make any sense to us. But it's just that rhythmic quality. And if you think in terms of Muslims, you listen to them praying, you listen to them reciting, it sounds like a very rhythmic chant. And that's coming from the Quran. And it is something that really entrances them, is the only way that I can say it. They hold the concepts, the rhetoric, the clarity of expression. You listen to them talk about them, taking it directly from the things they say. And they say it's without literary equal. There's nothing that equals it, they say. And Muslim apologists will argue those qualities prove the Quran comes directly from Allah. Now, I could get into a long, whole lesson about that, and it'd probably be extremely boring to most people here, and I just didn't think there was any point to doing that, because basically what you end up arguing is the Quran sounds better to us than anything on earth, so therefore it must be from Allah. You know, I don't know how you answer that, really. No, it's not. And, you know, we begin to look at we take a scientific approach to it, and they don't want to hear it. They don't want to talk about it. So it's from Allah because it sounds better and reads better than anything else. And that really is where they are with it. And they all regard the Quran, doesn't matter what sect you're talking about or whatever, they all regard the Quran as their sacred and authoritative text first. Now, they will differ on something else from Muhammad I'm about to bring. Well, not from Muhammad, but they will differ on the second level of books Bible, whatever, that I'm about to bring up, but they all agree the Quran is the sacred and authoritative text. None of them, no matter what sect we're talking about, disregards the Quran. Many contend Muhammad was illiterate, and this was something that I just accepted. I'd heard that so much and read that so much that I accepted that, and I really got to digging in it during this study. And I've about come to the conclusion that he may not have been illiterate, that that may be something that's simply a tag that's been stuck on him, and it focuses on one passage in one surah within the Quran. And the more I read that and listen to people debate that passage, I'm not convinced that's what he's saying. It doesn't matter. Okay, and so there's no point really getting off into that. But a lot of people contend he was illiterate, and that's why he didn't write the Quran. Regardless of all that, most people agree, even though he didn't pen the words, he dictated it. And they will say he dictated it verbatim. The very word Quran, as you can see here, is really from an Arabic word, qara'a, to recite. And if you say qara'a, or ah, it sort of in English sounds like Quran. I'm not really pronouncing it well, but it does somewhat. And that's where we get the word. So Quran or Quran, like that. It just means to recite. His followers transcribed his oral teachings into the Quran. Some passages were transmitted during his lifetime, although not written down. In other words, he's reciting them. They're making notes, memorizing, whatever, but it's not codified into the Quran. Many were preserved, however, most of it, admittedly, is preserved only in their memory and recorded after his death. This is another great argument to those that take the approach we would, that, compare that to inspiration and to that whole study from the Bible. Nonetheless, following his death, very shortly during the time, and we'll talk about in just a moment, the caliphs. In the time of the first caliph, Abu Bakr, standardized by the time of the third, and we'll talk about those times, that time frame we're talking about there, but very shortly after the Quran is produced. So that's the point. It's within a few years after the death of Muhammad that you have this book. Now, one final thing I'll say about it, and then I want to get into the development of the sects. The Quran is a non-chronological collection. And when I say that, think of your Bible for a moment. When you start in your Bible, basically, the Bible is chronological. And when I say that, I realize what I'm saying. But generally, it's chronological, meaning it starts with Genesis, the oldest time, and goes through the Old Testament, and then you come to the New Testament, which begins with the life of Jesus. Generally, even though it's arranged like a bookshelf, it's generally chronological. The Quran's all over the place. You don't start at the beginning of the Quran, which to us would be the back, but you don't start at the beginning of the Quran and read through in a general chronological way. It's haphazard. It's all over the place, which is an incredible way of collecting things to me, but nonetheless, it's non-chronological. These revelations are divided into 114 surahs, or chapters. Now think of the Bible. The Bible, Psalms itself, there's 150 of them. Isaiah, 66 chapters. Even in the New Testament, Matthew 28, etc. You have hundreds and hundreds of chapters. There's 114 surahs. The Bible has tens of thousands of verses, and yet there's a little over 6,000 verses. It's a short Bible, is the point. Relatively speaking, a very short Bible. The earlier surahs, supposedly those received when he was at Mecca, they're the ones that he's getting from Gabriel during these years before anybody even knows about it. They're primarily concerned with ethical and spiritual topics. Who is God, really? Allah is the God of Abraham. That gives you an idea. All of those kinds of things. Then when you get into Medina, naturally speaking, when he's bringing all these Arabic tribes together and forming them into a nation, a lot of social, moral issues of how they're to treat each other as brothers and all of that kind of thing. relevant to a Muslim community, naturally so. It focuses more, however, just in general, on moral guidance than legal instruction. You and I think of the Bible as law. Even the New Testament, we think in terms of God says, book, chapter, and verse, you must be this, you must do that. That's not really the idea of the Quran. There is some of that. You have to do this and you have to do that. But it's more moral guidance. It's general statements. And that's why when we get into some of the doctrine, there's all that debate. Does this surah, does that ayah, does it mean that you're supposed to do this or that? Kill Christians, for example. It's more ambiguous. It's not book, chapter, and verse law like the Bible is. So just understand that. That's one reason I put that in there, because it will be important later when we enter that whole study. It is, of course, the indisputable holy book, and they consider it the verbatim word of Allah. They say it couldn't be so unique, it couldn't be so beautiful, etc. I mean, you listen to them go into it, they think it is Allah speaking to them. And they regard it as such. In fact, they will tell you the Quran, not Muhammad. And they will stress that. They'll say, there's no reason for you to compare Muhammad to Jesus. Because we don't compare Muhammad to Jesus. It's the Quran. The Quran is to be compared with Jesus. And which is a very strange thing. But you have to understand how holy a book this is to them. And you know, really, when I'm looking at that and I'm listening to that, I kept thinking, well, I buy that. Because to me, this is the Word of God. And when I listen to this, this is God. This is God speaking. So I can respect that, even though that's ridiculed by a lot of religious people here in America. I dare say members of the church wouldn't ridicule. That would be something we would be in agreement. If it were literally the Word of God, it should be regarded as such a holy book. So that's one point I would be in agreement with them about. But that's where they are with it. Muslims, however, are guided by other works. Numerous teachings, examples, and statements of Muhammad on a lot of topics are contained in the Hadith. And this is where all the debate comes. You might say, if everybody is in so much agreement about the Quran, why do we have all these divisions within the Muslim community? Well, it's not the Quran, it's the Hadith. And Muhammad, a lot of his teachings, examples, statements, I don't know why you separate. I mean, sometimes I look at it and I say, well, why isn't that in the Quran or that in the Hadith? I mean, it seemed to me like you're talking about the same thing. But nonetheless, the Hadith of Muhammad is supposed to assist with the interpretation of the Quran, etc. And all Muslims understand this. All Muslims accept the Hadith. So they have the Quran, they have the Hadith of Muhammad, and they all enter in agreement on that. So far we have no division. These books address virtually every aspect of life. Remember, complete submission. It makes Islam not just a religion, but an all-encompassing way of life. Again, I'm not so much in disagreement with that, because Christianity is supposed to be an all-encompassing way of life as well. So not so much in disagreement as some other so-called people in Christendom would be. Now, consider where we are. Let's leave that for a moment, and then we'll come back to looking at some history. We've talked about the compelling story. What have we said? Well, there was Muhammad. Was he chosen by God? Did Gabriel force him to receive these revelations? If so, it's a compelling story. Was the religion of Allah that dates all the way back to Adam corrupted, and no one had it at the time, no one was practicing? If so, then it's a compelling story. All religions, were they insufficient? Well, if that religion of Adam and Noah and Moses had been lost or corrupted or changed over time by the 500s, AD 500s, then sure, they were insufficient and you would need something else. And Muslims believe all of that. Without doubt, whatever you think about Muhammad, no matter what you think of him, what he was able to accomplish is an amazing thing. If I look at him as a purely historical figure, like I said, you've heard me liken him two or three times now to Alexander the Great. You might think, wow, that's a lot of praise for Muhammad. In one sense, you stand up there and you say, in a very well-known lesson a few years back, that he was an epileptic nut. I believe that. I believe this is a guy that had fits of epilepsy, that in many respects he was a nut, and that he was able to take that, and he was able to convince people of that, of what he was saying, his ravings, or whatever you want to call them. But he has a flamboyance about him. He has a charisma about him. No one is able to garner people to himself like Muhammad was able to if he doesn't have that. If he doesn't have that amazing quality that very few people in history have had, Hitler had it. And I hate everything that I know about Hitler. But I respect the fact that he had that kind of flamboyant charisma that drew people, mesmerized people, and drew them to him. Where crowds of people listen to that garbage and then go out and kill people by the thousands. Muhammad had that. So when we're looking at leadership, out of all three cults, you may remember all the way back to the Mormons, I said Joseph Smith was a flamboyant charisma, and aside from maybe Muhammad, you know, because Muhammad, more than anybody, any of these leaders of any of these cults, is able to accomplish what no one else ever could, bringing all these tribes, I mean, people who had lived, think about it, people who had lived as nomadic, wandering, idolatrous tribes for thousands of years, and not Judaism in their countries or in their geographic areas, not Christianity in their geographic areas. None of that had been able to draw these people out of that way of life. And yet Muhammad is able to do that. So regardless of what you think about it, he certainly is that. And people are drawn to him and still are to this day, 1,500 years later. And we've talked about an alternate scripture. A scripture, the Quran, that is regarded on the level and argued in the place of Jesus Christ. And that's what they will tell you. You have Jesus, we have, as flamboyant as he was, not Muhammad, but the Quran, the revelations that he gave. That's an incredible thing. So that's where you are. But when it's all said and done, and you step back and you take an objective point of view, here's what you have. It's a religion of 1.5 billion people based completely on the secret, out in a cave, whirling around in an epileptic fit or whatever it was in the desert. Khadija and a few people see it. A secret, private experience or group of experiences of just one man. And 1.5 billion people are basing their lives and bombing people, etc., etc., based on that. Or to put it another way, and I like the way Kippy Myers, this guy is a professor of history, especially concentrating on the Muslim history, has some excellent works out. But as Kippy Myers said, when it's all said and done, why Christianity? Why the Bible? Well, because Islam, only one person allegedly saw the angel, only one person allegedly heard a voice, only one person allegedly saw the visions. The only way to become a Muslim, then, is to take one man's word for it. And that's what you have. When it's all said and done, that's where you are. Christianity doesn't even remotely claim to be that. I mean, you think about what you have in here, it's not remotely claiming to be the secret, private. In fact, Peter says just the opposite. Not of any private interpretation, 2 Peter chapter 1. We've emphasized that on Wednesday night. Just the exact opposite. So an open, objective religion, open to scrutiny, and God has made it so from the beginning, compared to a secret, private experience, revelation, a raving of one man. And that's what you really have. Now, we'll go further with the history a little bit, then I'll close and I'll bring us up to a point and we'll stop tonight. Muhammad had united these tribes of Arabia into a single Muslim religious polity, as it's called. However, following his death in 632, division had broken out over the next leader. I mean, obviously you had this conquered Saudi Arabia, but who's going to control it? There's a lot that goes with that. So who's going to control it? Well, Abu Bakr, Muhammad's companion and close friend, supposedly with him at the end there, et cetera, et cetera. Won't get off into Abu there. But his companion and close friend was named the first caliph, or more exact in Arabic, khalifa. Simply a word that means successor or representative. But he was named the first caliph. A caliph is a head of state in a caliphate or caliphate, and the leader of an Islamic community, also called an ummah. And the only reason I'm putting these words up there is because some other terms use these or employ these terms. Now, the early caliphs, and this really is important, because here's where the divisions began. Some of you have asked, in fact, several of you have asked about these divisions. Some of those you hear on the news from time to time. I'm about to name the two most prominent. The early caliphs were called the Caliphat Rasulallah, are the political, quote-unquote, successors to the messenger of Allah, successors to Muhammad, obviously. Caliphs were often referred to as amir, or the well-known word imam. Now, all imam means is leader. An amir is a commander. An imam is a leader, and the leader of the faithful. In other words, imam al-mumin, the leader of the faithful, the leader of the Muslims. But just remember the word imam and that it means leader, especially. Most Muslim governors, historically, have been referred to as sultans. That's where that word comes in, or emir. Now, imam or amir is not to be confused with emir. They gave their allegiance to a caliph. That's not all that important, but this is. Bakr successfully, or Abu really, successfully put down rebellions from the various Arab tribes. Naturally, if you've got such a charismatic leader as Muhammad, when he dies, chaos is going to break out. We see that all the time with leaders like this. Well, Muhammad died, chaos broke out. And the first thing that Abu was able to do is squelch that. I mean, you could have had it all breaking up, and it all had been for naught. We wish it had, but it could have all been for naught if you hadn't had a powerful leader to come behind Muhammad. Some have said that in movements like this, more important than the original guy is the guy that comes next, you know. And that's sometimes true. So he was able to do that. But not only did he do that, he was also able to avenge their, at the end of Muhammad's life, they had suffered a pretty big defeat in the area of what we would call eastern Turkey, the Byzantines. And the Byzantine Empire was on the rise. And he was able to avenge that and secure that area. Once and for all, because it's still secure to this day. After his death, he was succeeded by these next three. While their names are not all that important, the four together are. So I put their names up there. There is Umar and Uthman and Ali. Remember their last names or their first names, Oriental way of doing things. But anyway, Ali and that last one, Ali in particular. You see that they're coming in rapid succession about every 10, 12 years there. Well, they're doing that for a reason. I'll come back to that. But notice that these four are known by most Muslims, and I stress most Muslims, as the rightly guided caliphs. Under them, the Islamic caliphate, or the Islamic empire, if you will, greatly expanded. It went into Persia or Iran, into Byzantine or Byzantium, that includes Palestine and eastern Turkey territories and so forth. If you're looking at this map, your pinkish colored area, in that next 20, 30 years there, that's the next 25 years or so, that's the area that's conquered. You see how it's expanding into Africa. You see how it's going east into Iran. You see how it's retaking the area even through eastern Turkey. So you have that area under those four caliphs very quickly. Now, each of these, however, came to power in the face of a lot of internal opposition. Those last three gained power by assassinating their predecessor, or their cohorts did. So you got, basically what you have is a period where there's a lot of unrest. There's outward conquest, but there's inward civil war going on. bloody and violent time. A lot of blood, a lot of violence. And I put in red, does that sound familiar? Because they've never been any different. What begins with Muhammad, as I said last week, continues through the rest of their time, their history, and it still does today. They just fight and fight and fight. Ali, the fourth caliph, was himself assassinated in 661 when Muawiyah, the governor of Levant. Levant was a province at that time that encompassed modern-day Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Israel, and greater Palestine. He seized power, and that began a 70-year period of the Umayyad dynasty. A lot of conquest, a lot of building of mosques. This is one, literally, in northern Africa, in Tunisia. Yeah, Tunisia, that still exists. It's prototypical. The architecture represents what modern mosques look like. What began in that time in the 660s A.D. still continues today. This is right on the northern coast of Africa, where this particular one still exists to this day. So a lot of that kind of thing going on. But the conflict over religious and political leadership gave rise to a permanent division. And let me end with this point. Permanent division within the Muslim community. The majority of people accepted all four of those caliphs, and they became known as the Sunnis. You probably have heard that on the news. A more radical minority only accepted the fourth, Ali, as a legitimate successor to Muhammad. And they are now known as, and became known then as, the Shia or Shiites. So if you ever heard on the news, the Shiite Muslims did this, so they did that. Well, this goes all the way back to this fourth caliph. These sects continue to this day, and their various philosophies are fundamental to the division that goes on, the wars and everything else that goes on within the Muslim community. The Sunnis are the largest branch by far of Islam. Most Muslims are Sunnis, often referred to as Orthodox Muslims, probably for that reason. They claim to follow all the teachings of Muhammad in both those books, the Quran and the Muhammadan Hadith. Now, I stress that because the Shiites, who are the second largest group, though much smaller, they believe Ali, who was Muhammad's cousin and son-in-law, was the first imam, the only rightful successor at that time to Muhammad. They called him the perfect man. And they believe certain individuals among his descendants, meaning Ali's descendants, known as imams, so if you ever hear the term Muslim imam, that's who you're talking about, those guys have rightful spiritual political authority, and they themselves, many of them through history, or several, I should say, through history, have left for us hadiths, remember teachings, examples that have been written down, etc. These are attributed to Muhammad and these imams, and Shiites follow those. Now, what does that mean? First, I might say, okay, well, what's the important point of that? And let me stop here and just make this point. Here's what you have today. If some imam came along then or now, and he's regarded as a rightful descendant and a rightful heir to Muhammad, he might issue some particular statement, modern revelation from Allah. Really, they would say it's not a revelation, it's more an interpretation of what Muhammad had said, what's in the Quran. He might, for example, issue an edict about blowing somebody up or killing somebody or starting a war or whatever. The most likely people who are going to jump on the bandwagon and follow that are the Shiites. Because they are going to regard this imam as a spiritual and political authority with a rightful descendancy to Muhammad. And that's why you get such radical people within the Muslim community as separate from maybe some other more, quote-unquote, orthodox people. Now I'm going to start there, and that's right where I'll pick up next week. The history obviously goes on. It'll bring us into very quickly bring us into modern times, and we'll continue to focus on groups like these two.